to Going Shamanic. My name is Jennifer Ingracio. My medicine name is Snowhawk. I'm pleased to host this show on Walking with Grief. Today's show is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking callers. This past September, as some of you may know, my grandma of Almería passed away. She was just shy of her 96th birthday. The gift of Alzheimer's is also wrapped up in the challenge of it. On the one hand, seeing someone you love lose their mind can be heart-wrenching and distressing. I had to come to grips with the fact that Avo might not recognize me or be able to engage in a conversation with me at any given time when I visited her. I was angry at her initially for choosing this way to fade out of life. I had to face a lot of my issues around death and my control issues with life. I know that death is a part of life, and both are great teachers for those willing to learn from them and grow while they're here on Earth. I know sometimes I turn away from them out of fear, but I also know the importance of facing them. Grief gives the opportunity, and I took it. The gift of Alzheimer's is that it gave me time to let go in stages and grieve fully before my grandma's death. I got the chance to really look at my attitudes around death, dying, and life, to come to terms with them. But I also got a chance to say goodbye to someone I love with all my heart. I got a chance to say the things I had to say. I consciously valued the last opportunities to touch her, massage her skin, and love her up while I could still be with her in the flesh. The last time I visited my grandma at her care home, I spent an hour massaging her arms and legs and hands while she relaxed and looked at the window and out at the trees in the spring. At one point, she gave me a leg that I'd already massaged, and she said, "Faz, faz," which in Portuguese means do it, do it. I laughed, and I gave her what she wanted. I barely said a word to her the whole hour I was there. We did this somatic and spirit dance that was intimate and loving. And we said more in an hour of not speaking than in an hour of talking. And I thought, what a gift just to be able to be together. It was a relief not to feel like I had to chatter away. All of my earthly titles, degrees, and achievements didn't matter one iota. All that mattered was two humans connecting. Sometimes when I struggle with the predominant worldview we live in, of achievements and titles, I think about what will matter to me when I'm readying to die. And reflecting back on my life. I doubt my university degree will be on my mind. Although it seemed cruel to me at the beginning, I now see the wisdom that came out of walking alongside my grandma on her Alzheimer's journey. Since my grandma's passing, I've been reflecting on how long almost a century is in human years, but how really it's just such a short time. We really only have a blink of an eye's worth of time in each lifetime to make positive impact. Avo's death was a reminder of how precious life is, and it also drove home the fact that our bodies are of the earth, that there is a sacred connection with this planet that we're birthed from, that can only be honored while we're here in human form. I felt tremendous surges of gratitude for being able to taste a peach, make love, walk barefoot on the grass, and feel the wind on my skin or the warmth of the sun on my body. I can't experience those wonderful things in spirit form. I've made a renewed commitment to really living fully with aliveness, and I thank my Avo for helping me to remember the preciousness of life and for all the blessings she brought into my life's journey while we were here together. Our guest today knows a lot about grieving and living deeply. Stephen Jenkinson is a teacher, author, storyteller, spiritual activist, ceremonialist, and founder of the Orphan Wisdom School, a teaching house and learning house for the skills of deep living and making human culture. It is a redemptive project that comes from where we came from. It is rooted in knowing history, being claimed by ancestry, and working for a time we may not see. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, ma'am.
So what do you mean by spiritual activist when you call yourself that?
I don't call myself that, but somebody did write it down. And so, I try to live up to it on occasion when I remember to. Well, I think The thrust of it is something like this. You know, living deeply is not a lifestyle option available amongst many more. Living deeply is your basic sort of blood debt that you have with life itself. I put it that way. So you don't have a choice. You can opt out. I wouldn't call that a choice. I'd call that a, you know, an active, almost betrayal of what's entrusted to us as far as, you know, our capacity for alertness and ingenuity, tremendous brilliance at times, and all the other things that that could mark every human era and rarely do. So you could say that living deeply is a is the mandate that comes with being born. I suppose being a spiritual activist then would be nothing more than making the case for that, and occasionally being in a tremendous drag at parties because you keep somehow insisting that this is the priority for us. You know, we live in a fairly troubled time. I don't think anybody can argue that. At least our corner of the world is deeply troubled, deeply bereft, you know, on a number of matters. And now more than ever, that kind of obligation seems paramount. And maybe not so much for our benefit, you know, the benefit of the people, you know, living and breathing, or at least in their 30s or 40s or 50s right now, because, you know, trouble is at hand. I don't think we're going to see, let's say, the fruits of being willing to live in the way I've just described, but it can fall to us to leave that possibility as what we bequeath to the generations to come, who are likely to live in a much more troubled time, certainly ecologically, than I was ever dreamt of when I was, you know, born only 60 years ago. That's the tone of spiritual activist to my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, I work with kids, so with the kids, the spiritual aspect of life is so present. They're so present. And so, but they're living in this world that denies that spiritual aspect of us. So
I think it's worse than denying it. I think at best it's a rumor, you know, in the way that dominant culture in North America lives. It's not like it's argued or argued against. It's left. And, you know, that thing can go dormant in a hurry when the cultural life around you proceeds otherwise. I think it's grimmer than it has no adversary, you could put it that way. Disinterest is the adversary of living deeply now.
Mm-hmm. And I see the distress in the kids from, you know, that having that contrast of what they know and then always being faced with this other thing.
this other nothing.
Right. And being in the nothingness of it and the anxiety of it and the, you know, everything that comes from it, really.
Well, the anxiety doesn't last too long, you know, because the appetite for what we're describing can't really survive the onset of you know, deep adolescence. It generally doesn't. I mean, we consider adolescence a kind of behavior management era. You know, the adults do, and it's basically deemed to be a time-limited problem, hopefully. And I don't think that that having the taste for things spiritual really survives the way young people are parented, to be frank. So it's worse than anybody thinks it is.
Now, I mean, the show is on walking with grief. What do you see as the connection between the two things, that kind of spiritual amnesia and the grief, the way we do grief?
Grief is how you awaken to that. You know, you don't awaken out of spiritual amnesia. You awaken to it. There's a massive difference. You know, awakening has got a terrible and very false label attached to it. It's, you know, somehow there's this, seems to be this uncritical feeling, which is more like longing in North America, that awakening is its own reward, you know, all, I mean, even the word awakening has this kind of positive, gauzy, new age-ness about it that's invariably welcome, pleasant, and has a wonderful payoff. And I'm really suggesting that awakening in a time like ours is done so not accompanied by hallelujah chorus, not accompanied by amens. It's accompanied by a sob. That's the sound that awakening people, awakening to a time such as ours, more or less are obliged to make. You know, it's awakening to the fact that many of us, I'd say most of us, have been on the take for the lion's share of our lives. You know, not through any grotesque, malice of intent. I mean, this is the hardest part to realize. You know, we're on the take not because we're bad people. We're on the take because the deal that we were born into, which looks so much like life, is actually one of the most acquisitive and heart-rending deals that humans, I think, have ever struck with the world and with the divine. And when you awaken to that, you realize you didn't do anything. You didn't choose that. No one presented it to you as one of many options when you were, you know, 13 or 19. And so you awaken to it almost involuntarily as a consequence of some other kind of experience or mayhem or whatever it might be. And we should say over and over again that awakening is far from inevitable, that living this kind of spiritually toned existence that we talked about earlier, there's nothing inevitable about that. There's nothing inevitable about awakening. So if you have this mixed blessing called coming to some kind of alertness involuntarily, it's mostly sorrow that accompanies that in the early going. And the realization that at some level it was supposed to be otherwise, and it couldn't have been otherwise because of the time that we were born into. It couldn't have been otherwise. Well, what other feeling tone can there be? A tone of awareness has to be grief now. It's not grief-free. It's not floating above it with a sense, you know, a generic sense of well-being that can't be disturbed. I think having a conscience now is a grief-soaked proposition. And I should just articulate one or two things about this word grief. Uncritically, most people come to this word as if it's a synonym for other feelings, you know, like, oh, I don't know, sadness, misery, you know, despondency, depression, and the rest. In fact, I would say that existentially, there is no synonym for grief. It's a standalone thing, and it's not a feeling. It's an understanding. You see that your feelings pass through, perhaps, and otherwise don't. You could say it this way: all feelings tend to have this shelf life about them, and thank God they do. They're like weather. They're all real, but not very tenacious, not really, over time. Grief, on the other hand, is a kind of, it's what imbues your understanding with a sense of urgency and gives you a sense that you're somewhere, that you're not hovering. In the case of, you know, I'm a white guy, I'm 60 years old, those two things, well, once I was asked by an interviewer, what would you consider your great influence on your life? And I thought about it for 4 seconds, and I said, well, I was born 9 years after the close of Auschwitz. I would call that a heavy influence indeed. Not that I was even aware that there was such a thing as Auschwitz for, God, who knows how many years after I was born. But yet, that's in the air. It certainly was in the air in North America by how far away everybody could run from it and make like it was the bad old days, you know. And, of course, it was eclipsed with the nuclear thing, so I didn't, things didn't improve much. But that's the air and the water I was born to. And it took a little while to have its way with me and to show up. But I think a grief-soaked understanding is a kind of moral obligation now instead of an affliction.
So it sounds like it's like what you're saying is that we're born into this we're born into grief really in a way because of the history of the planet.
Well, I don't want to say it like it's an inevitable thing though. It's we're not quote born into grief. We're born to the possibility that grief can be our understanding now. It's not the thing that wipes out your understanding, makes it impossible, or punishes you for having it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, different eras, I'm certain, had different tones that people in them were born to. I don't think this is chronic by any means. I don't think it's part of, quote, of the human condition. I mean, that language is useless to any of us. The idea that, quote, it's always been this way, or universally people feel this way no matter where you go. This is not true. There's a lot of people who, for example, don't identify with the extraordinary blight that when you come into every large town, they look exactly the same now all over North America. They got the same shit out there, the same stores, the same everything. There's a, you know, I mean, I die a little bit when I see that stuff, but not everybody does. A lot of Aboriginal people I know, they smile about it, not because they enjoy it, but they don't identify with that affliction. They don't look at those malls and say, look what we did. Mm-hmm. If they say anything, they say, well, they're still at it, aren't they? Mm-hmm. So you see, it's possible that you're not born inevitably to this at all. In our time, when there's so much reward for not letting this awaken inside you, grief's an achievement. And I prefer to use that word to hold it as an achievement, the same way I hold the word dying as an achievement, because there's nothing inevitable about that either.
Yeah, and I guess I should maybe preface something that I said, because the grieving that I do or that I've done, I don't see as an affliction at all. I'm grateful for it because the apathy is much worse for me. That feeling of being in that apathy place, you know, when that soldier was killed in Canada.
Oh yes.
Last week, I felt all that, and I'm glad I felt all that, and that I didn't stay in this, you know, non-feeling or apathetic place about it, because I knew, even though it was happening across the country where I don't live, that still doesn't mean that it didn't have anything to do with me, or that it's not affecting me in some way. Mm. So to me, I don't consider grief an affliction at all. I consider it a part of my humanness, a part of being alive. I haven't felt so alive as I have when I'm just allowing myself to really be with what's actually here, instead of, even if it doesn't feel fantastic.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could shift the word alive just ever so slightly and say, it's grief is one of the conditions and qualities of our kinship with each other as humans, with everything else in the world that's not human upon which we depend for our lives. And everything that, you know, we maybe for the moment could refer to as the unseen world. Our kinship with those other things, those other ones, that's conducted, you could say, with grief at hand. I mean, when I say that and I hear myself say it, I said, man, that shit's powerful to imagine that grief is a kind of kinship that's not inevitable. But without it, the chances are really good that people are going to seek a kind of kinship with the divine and with the world that's basically trouble-free. Mm-hmm. That seems to be our idea of a good time, or that's what, quote, natural. That's the natural we're bargaining for now. And I don't think it's in the cards. I think the slight that has been exacted upon the world in order for us to have the kind of life that we've had invites us to a kind of participate in a mutual grief. I'm not sure if the world actually grieves, really. Maybe it's a human maybe we're like a tuning fork for what we do. And maybe our grief is the note that is sung as a consequence of us coming to know, you know, how it is and what we've done with what are truly are our kin and our relatives and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've spent a lot of time singing at funerals and attending funerals my entire life. You know, in a Portuguese culture, there's always somebody being born or dying, or you know, there's a lot.
Like everywhere else. I understand what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So instead of having 30 relatives, you end up having many more, which I know is not probably a mainstream experience for everybody in Canada, maybe with smaller family units. But from a really young age, I noticed that, you know, a lot of times there were a lot of people at the funeral that didn't necessarily know the person that died. They were there out of obligation or because their family knew them or somebody had to send a representative, you know.
Right, sure.
And it was interesting because the feeling was like this overwhelming sense of grief, but far beyond the death of this one person. It was like people use funerals to allow themselves to grieve because there's no other place to do that kind of work, really, in our culture.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, it's not my language, this allowing thing, to be frank. I don't think that's in the cards at all. I think that's what we say so that we can make, that's the language we use to maintain this rather goofy and completely unsubstantiable, that's not a word. You can't make a case for you being in charge of grief, that you give yourself permission to do it, and so on. It's not how it works. That thing is so big, it doesn't matter what you think about it. And you're certainly not driving the bus where grief is concerned. I mean, you can be standing there in a bus holding the handrail, and for reasons that you only try to figure out later, this lump wells up in your throat that seems to have no cause. It has a moment of detonation, you know, but oftentimes those moments are seem minor and not that big a deal at first blush. And, you know, how to make sense of that? Well, it's certainly not you doing it. God knows. It's life having its way with you, which you can be eternally grateful for when that happens. So I think people come to events such as you describe on the off chance that, I mean, in addition to the reasons you said, you know, there are obligations, and that's a perfectly legitimate word to use. Of course there are obligations to attend, either as a representative of your family or from the workplace or because you're a human and you were breathing the same breath as they breathed for a while and now they're not and you still get to do it. What do you call that? Yes, there's a lot of gratitude in it, but the gratitude is only really detonated by your realization that it won't continue. So what do you call that? You see, and that's grief. And it's not demanding that it was otherwise or claiming that you're being ripped off because you don't get to live for 300 years. It's more like it's this kind of reluctant amen that escapes your lips from time to time, which is to say, wow, this deal is so much vaster than I bargained for. And when I get depressed and shit like that, generally it's because I forget that whole aspect of things. And I'm down to grievance, you know, as being the tone that I keep singing. So certainly public events like memorial services and the rest, they're kind of the most obviously staged place where this might show itself among us. But I don't think it's certainly not exclusive. The grief you and I are talking about is not exclusive in any way to funerals, because it's not exclusive to dying. The grief we're talking about has a lot to do with a combination of a hunger for life, a wish that life were otherwise sometimes, certainly, and a willingness to be carried by it at the end of the day. You usually have to work on that 40 or 50 years, frankly, to be willing to acknowledge that life is bigger than your ideas about it, and death is pretty much the same, and that everything that happens in between when you're born and you're dying is your chance to get it right. And the whole thing is underwritten by grief, but it's not sadness, because grief is the midwife of your capacity to be immensely grateful for being born.
That's what I was trying to say.
I heard you, my dear. I'm just translating.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, it's hard to find, well, for me, it's always been hard to find words.
Yeah.
That do what I'm experiencing.
So you're in radio now.
Yeah, exactly. And I've written a book. But that's just me going, okay, let me see if
you're
I can
do working on
this.
It. You're working on the mysteries. I understand.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you've worked with a lot of people that are dying.
Dead now.
With their families.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What can you share about that process, and how on earth did you get into that line of service?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't my idea. I didn't know that such a thing really existed as a kind of discrete job description, and it turned out when I got into it, it didn't. By which I mean this. I was just invited to do something for a group of men in a hospital. That's how it started. It was a very small little beginning. I didn't want to do it because I'm not organizationally capable, frankly. I'm just not bent that way, and I knew it was going to go to hell eventually, and eventually it did, but while I was there, man, I got some dangerous stuff done, I'll tell you. But what I discovered, I thought I was in I call it the death trade, which is a completely legitimate way of describing it. Most people call it palliative care or hospice palliative care. I thought I was there to, quote, help people die, unquote. And it took me quite a while to realize it's palpably not the case that anybody's there to help somebody die, and here's why. We got a deathphobic culture. That's the beginning of any wondering about this whole dying thing. You got to realize that not every culture is like ours where this death thing is concerned. And our culture has a reward system based on not dying, based on not living with your death very long or very intensely. Having little glimpses of it and then moving on to more promising things, etc. We keep our kids away from the graveside. We keep our teenagers away from suicide. And everything after that is, pursuing your gross, income potential earning and just having a good time. Well, nobody wants to die in the first place. So how are you going to help them die? The answer is you got no takers. So I realized I actually had to cultivate the idea that dying is waiting for you to pursue it or approach it. That your death, in that sense, is quite personal. It's entrusted to you. Your particular death is entrusted to you to take care of, much the same way your life is. Antonio Machado, this great Spanish poet from the early part of the last century, he had a line in there where he says, "The wind came to me one day." The wind is what we were talking about earlier, about, let's say, everything not human in this world. And it said to me, "Here, you've got this gorgeous aroma that you're capable as a human being of wonder and things like that. I'll trade that for this aroma I have," which is, I believe, jasmine in the early part of the poem. And the human keeps saying, "But I don't have that," or "I forgot it," or "I don't know where it is," or "I don't know what you mean." And the last line of the poem has every not human thing in the world saying to the human being, "What have you done with this garden that was entrusted to you?" It's just an epic and aching sort of line. Well, your dying is one of the things, one of the flowers in the garden that was entrusted to you. Have you cared for it as if it needed caring for? Or have you beat it away with a stick every time it came anywhere close as the guardian angel that it certainly is? And you know what I'm saying, because every dying person, almost without exception, came to their dying time shocked as if, what the hell's this? Nobody told me about this. I didn't sign up for this, and things of that kind. Or the other face of exactly the same coin, which is, well, fuck it, it's over, I'm done. You know, it's there's nothing. I hate this. I hate my body, the parts of it that still work, and so forth. And I could quote you things that were said that would raise your hair. And all of this seems to suggest that your dying is kind of like an ambush. So that's what I found in the early going, that nobody wanted help with this. What they wanted was your help in getting them not to die. Well, they're dying anyhow. So most of them spent their dying time not dying, if you know what I mean by that phrase. And my job was to get them to die, strangely enough. So it's not inevitable that you will. You put the brakes on, or now these days, you look for somebody to hurry it up. Euthanasia and so forth. And in both cases, you're refusing to die, such that, you know, when people kept asking me, write a book about this, write a book, and I resisted it for years, and, well, there's one coming out now in the spring, and it's called Die Wise. And the tone of that title says it all. I'm not saying, well, you could consider dying wise, or, you know, it would be good for you to die wise. Or, well, there's a lot of possibilities. Dying wise is one of them. Would you like to think about that? No, the tone of this book is, listen to me now. I've seen a lot of people who chose otherwise, and I'm telling you now, this is the only one wherein your humanity gets a chance to show up for duty, to die wise. It's your obligation as a moral person, a political person, a spiritual being, a social person, and the rest. It's what we owe to everything that died before us to keep us alive, you know, food-wise and the rest. And you try selling that in palliative care. Just try it. You know, you won't last a day. Not saying it in the naked way, I've just said it to you now. So I learned the hard way. I learned what I was not there to do for the longest time before I decided to risk it all and take a chance that that sanity could be found. And that's the subtitle of the book. It's called Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. And I guess I'm still on. You can sort of hear that there's a slight urgency in my voice about these matters because mm-hmm. I've seen what dying badly does. And the consequences of bad dying do not end when that person's breath stops. They continue. You could even say they multiply. And the concentric circles of bad death basically wash over everyone who's not even thinking about it. That's what I saw, and that's what's at stake. You know, basically it's our mutual life together that's at stake every time somebody's dying, especially when they're dying badly.
So when you how do you work with people at that stage to help them accept what's happening and to die wise, and to how do you work with their family members too, because that's a mm-hmm. whole other piece, right?
Well, it's an extension of it, but first of all, I never worked with anybody to get them to accept. I find that whole acceptance mantra obscene, to be frank, because, you know, I mean, even on my bad days, I don't walk around saying, this is a shitty deal. Here I am with this friggin' body, and you know, and there's air, and shit like that. This is terrible. I mean, it's never crossed my mind. I know there are people for whom it does. I'm not one of them. So, what I'm saying is life's habit forming. You know, even when you're having a hard year or era or whatever it is, even life is kind of habit forming, and you're under no obligation when you're dying to decide, right, I've had enough. Not at all. So there's got to be an alternative to accepting. And it is. It's in this word amen that I said earlier, which some people don't like because of the biblical overtone to it. I'm telling you, amen is a gorgeous word because it means something like, you know, this deal is so much vaster than I ever understood or bargained for. That me saying yes or no, true or false, it really pales. It's really not that significant. What I can do is say, you know, the vastness of this thing has registered upon me to the extent where I'm just wowed by it. It's past whether I approve of it or not. So you could say one of the things I've done over the years when I'm working with dying people is to talk them out of misery just long enough to make a little, to make some room for wonder, you know, for wonder, not in the sense of being confused, but in the sense of being willing to understand this is so much bigger than you thought, isn't it? You thought you knew what dying was all about. You thought it was the cancellation of the old deal. Now you find out that the deal deepens if you give it half a chance. That part of you loves being alive more now than when you're able to walk around and, you know, look at other people in the eye and, you know, and be miserable in the mall and all that stuff. It, you know, the deal was amazing. And the fact that it's ending deepens the amazement. And that's what I fundamentally tried to do. I wasn't talking people out of their sorrow. I was saying, with this sorrow comes a deeper appetite for being alive. What a deal.
Like a sense of gratitude.
Yeah, gratitude comes from that, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in working with kids, I mean, they are always wondering about death, about sex, about all the things that we don't want to really, you know, most adults don't want to talk to them about these things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what would you say to parents who, whose kids are wondering about these things and they're not sure how to approach it or, you mm-hmm. know, have a communication with their kids about
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Oh, boy, this is a big one. First thing I'd say is to any parents, you know, listening to this right now, wondering about that is to say, hey, consider the limits of your capacity right now. Allow in the real possibility that you ain't that good at this stuff, that you haven't done your homework, you know, your so-called due diligence on the big matters of life, number one. Number two, even if you have done, none of that stuff qualifies you to be the father confessor or the spiritual genius in your kid's life. I mean, get it straight. If you're lucky, your kid outgrows you early. That's what the village is for. That's what the community's for. The community's there to take care of your kid in a way that genetics alone mean you're not able to do. Of course, I understand that that's not where most people live. Do you know, I get emails with some sad frequency from, it's almost always moms, and they have teenage sons on their hands. And they're writing me to see if they can send them to me. Not from around the corner, from the other side of the ocean, from countries that they don't even speak English in. Can they send their kids to me? Why? Well, they're concerned, of course, but the deeper why is there's nobody where they live that can pick up where parenting leaves off. Nobody. Because everybody's in it for their own situation, and of course we have this horrible idea about privacy, this horrible idea that the principal relationship in your life is a parental one, and then this horrible obligation that you feel should you become a parent later on, that you're in the kind of person-making business, you know, as a parent, when you're not at all. You certainly are that basically for anybody else's kid. You can have that consequence in their lives. But for your own kid, you're a janitor in their life, right? It's a custodial operation. You're just trying to keep them out of the traffic and more or less well enough fed to get them to the point where they can walk out your door and they don't darken your door for a long time. And when they do come back, you know, which hopefully is years, I don't mean this literally, but figuratively, when they do come back, one of the first things they say to you is, man, I had no idea. You know, when I was walking around being how I was, and I had no idea. You know, the older I get, the smarter you become, is hopefully what they can say to you. But they can't say that to you if they're chronically your kid. They can only say that to you when the world has cared for them. We live in a corner of the world that utterly doesn't believe in that stuff. And man, it's every family for themselves. And all I can say is, it's an obscene degree of expectation and torment to place on the shoulders of, you know, single parent families or double parent families, for that matter. A family cannot carry the burden of person making and doesn't. And North America is rife with divorce, and I just told you why.
And so what does ancestry have to do with that? Because, you know, I'm first generation Canadian. My parents are both Portuguese.
Yeah.
And yet, so I have a more of a handle on who my ancestors were than most people that I meet in Canada. You know,
yeah.
Most Canadians I meet say, oh, well, I'm Canadian.
Yeah.
And I say, well, no, your ancestors came from somewhere else.
Sure.
You know, or they're mixed in with people that were here, the First Nations people already.
Yes.
And that's a really hard concept for people to, well, it's not even a concept, it's just, it is. It's a really hard thing for people to grasp. But what does that have to do with the people making that you talk about and also the grief that we experience?
Sorry, what was less hard? And also what?
Sorry, say that again, Stephen?
And what was the last part of your question, and also, I didn't hear it.
It seems to me that they're connected, right? This not knowing who your ancestors are in grief, but also not knowing who your ancestors are and what you were talking about the families, thinking that they have to do it all on their own.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, it occurred to me one day that there's a kind of sorrow that accrues to people new to this continent, and there's a kind of sorrow that accrues over the last 500 years or so to people who are not new to this continent. And here struck me as this is one of the differences and at the same time one of the similarities. People like myself and like you, eventually we awaken to the realization, man, we ain't from here. And in the real sense of the term, we don't belong here either. Belong doesn't mean you're not supposed to be here. You know, why don't you go back where you came from? Although the case can be made, why don't we? But belong simply is a statement of fact. It means you don't derive from this earth, from the life ways, human and otherwise, of this part of the world. And your presence here is a consequence, if not an accident. It's a consequence of larger, you know, economic and political upheavals from an earlier time who still are not spent. They're still not done. And you're basically thrown up on these shores. Nobody teaches the history of this continent that way. I know in school with, you know, the old idea, people came here for, quote, a better life. And nobody came here because, you know, the mosquitoes alone are a good reason not to come. No, people came here running as fast as they could from something, only to discover that whenever you flee, it's the first thing you pack in your traveling case is the thing you're trying to get away from. Because you got no skill in living otherwise, that's why. So, the people like you and I, we wake up every day with the absence of what we lost by the immigration. And yes, the losses are real. I'm not saying they're final by any means, but they certainly are real, especially if you haven't awoken to this. On the other hand, you could say that Aboriginal people on this continent wake up every day in the presence of what they lost. And I'm not sure which hell is harder to live, to be frank. I'm not sure which one I'd trade for of those two, because God knows they both have their affliction and their consequence. So, what does ancestry have to do with what we're talking about? Well, two things. First of all, knowing who your ancestors are as a piece of information, this is good, it's interesting. It persuades you you're not exactly from nowhere, but it doesn't necessarily have any redemptive consequence for your understanding of anything, because it doesn't describe how you are about that ancestry, simply that you, quote, know about it. You know, a lot of us got ancestry that it is challenging or impossible to be proud of. That's true. Not all the bad guys die and leave no heirs, you know. A lot of the, I'm using the phrase bad guys in quotation marks. A lot of the bad guys, they got heirs too. They're ancestors to an awful lot of people too, as we sit here and talk about it now. So what about them? When we talk about ancestors, what are we picturing? a lot of people who look like Santa Claus sitting by the fireplace making a chair for you. Is that, I think that's what a lot of people think, actually. And in truth, you know, we're talking about death now, so death is what's required for you to have ancestors. They have to have been dead for some time already. And so the question is, the intervening generations between you and, say, an ancestor of, say, six generations ago, those five generations, did they live their lives in the presence of these ancestors? Did they carry them along? Did they include them in their mutual life and in their spiritual understanding of things? Did they in any way care for them beyond just in a neutral way remembering them? Or did they use them like the way we use a vending machine today, just to go to when it suits us, and as soon as we're feeling better, they're the first casualty? Because if that's the way it was, I'm fairly sure that when you awaken to your ancestry in 2014, you're not going to, quote, return to people who are necessarily doing okay, necessarily glad to see you, necessarily rewarding you for your considerable labors of trying to approach them. There's a lot of consequences, and I'm losing a lot of credibility with people listening right now because they probably think, you know, I got a Ouija board at my right hand. No, that's not the case. I came to this, you know, let me hesitate to remind everybody, I came to what I'm saying by working with dying people who became dead. I didn't come to this stuff thinking about it on my own or reading a book. And these dead people, you know, almost everybody I work with is dead now. That's a lot of people. What have they become? Do they just become, you know, what we remember about them or how we feel about them, which is usually what most people mean when they're talking about dead family and ancestors? They amount to, you know, our projections about them. Is there any other reality to the dead except how we feel about them? Well, surely there is. And if there is it possible to say that the dead need things from the living and it's not a one-way street? Is that possible? And if it is, are there consequences for us not keeping our end up where ancestry is concerned? I'm saying there is. So this is an enormous discussion to have with many things hanging in the balance. I could just end up this answer by saying something like this. People say often hypothetically, well, what would a culture look like that doesn't practice this this kind of initiation of its young you're talking about? And I say, well, look around. This is what it looks like. Well, what would a culture look like that doesn't care for its ancestors? And I say, well, look around. We're not waiting to find out what the consequences are. You know, as Leonard Cohen so gorgeously said in one of his songs, well, we asked for signs. The signs were sent. And I think the case will someday be made that the life that we are living, that the mayhem that we've inflicted on the planet and each other, is in no small way a consequence of our inability or our unwillingness to proceed in the presence of an ancestry that is absolutely and utterly needing us. And we live the consequence today.
So I want to get a little bit more to our relationship with the earth, and you're kind of leading us there by this by speaking about our ancestry.
Yes.
For me, in my experience, the two have absolutely run together.
Yes.
I haven't been able to separate them at all.
Good for you.
From my
good
connection to the earth to how my ancestors still kind of press on me. And, you know, even just the ways that they appear in my everyday life, things I was taught, things to a certain extent, some of my values, things that are really important to me. Portuguese people, very connected to the earth, at least my grandparents' generation.
Mm.
And so to me, when I think about my ancestry, the earth and my ancestry go hand in hand because my grandparents were farmers. They lived off the land.
Yeah.
So I haven't I haven't lost that connection to the earth like I see some of my peers have mm-hmm. that didn't have that direct connection with the ancestor right behind them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how and I know there's a grief around it. I feel that mm-hmm. with
sure.
people. How do we possibly start with all that?
Here's where the question gets difficult. This is where the question gets difficult. Hey, how do we, well, what exactly?
Yeah.
How do we what? How do we, what, fix
right.
it? I mean, you know, how do we make a better question than what do we do about it? So here's the first thing is, the first answer is you learn. And the next thing you realize is, shit, that's really costly, learning. It's really hard on you, learning. It's not like knowing at all. It's a whole other order of things. Second thing is, you realize this word ancestor, you know, to say it again, what if the, quote, the ancestors are not here for you, just like the world is not here for you? You know, I've said many a time, the world is not, you know, a petting zoo for your mind. What if ancestors are not like the great filing cabinet of comfort, that they're just laying there dormant and inert until activated by you seeking them out, and the rest of the time, what, they're fine? So it comes to this. They're not a concept. Ancestry's not a concept. I mean, look at your nose inside view. That wasn't your idea. You never would have designed it like that, you know? It's just true. And if it's not your nose, it's your chin. And if it's not that, it's something else. All these are signs that you come from somewhere and some from other people. And none of you was your idea. That's one thing. Second thing is this. You know, I kind of thought you were going to say it, but your tie to your ancestors through the land is not largely because they were farmers. In a much more compelling way, I think it comes down to this. Humans led ways of life for a long time, deeply disturbed now, but for a long time, in the following fashion, just to generalize. We call it nomadic. I prefer to think of it as obedient, meaning they weren't leading their flocks over hill and dale. They were following them. Of course they were, because the animals were nosing out the better feed and so on, and they were moving seasonally and the rest. So as you went on your path, even if you just went to two places, a summer place and a winter place, what's happening during the course of your travels, of course, is that your people are dying, as they do. And nobody packed them in ice, you know, or freeze-dried them. They were buried where they fell, pretty much. And you know, back and forth across your ancestral wanderings, your dead are scattered, or you could say planted. Now, as time goes by and your flocks are seeking out their nourishment by virtue of the grass and the grains that come out of the ground, what place do they seem to be drawn to over and above all other places? And the answer is, guess what? The very place where your people are buried, because, you know, biodynamically, that's the healthier ground, fed by the corpses of the people that once sounded and looked like you. Now, you eat those animals, or you eat their, you know, their milk or what have you, or you dress in their skins or in their fleece. You tell me who's taking care of you now.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a concept? Is this an idea? Is this a symbol? Or is this the way it's been for most of human history, such that we live now, you know, close to a Walmart? In place of that, where are you going to stand and point to the ground and say, this is where my people are? Almost nobody on this continent can do that. I mean, numerically. This is the loss I'm talking about. It takes enormous courage, enormous conviction, and enormous willingness to learn and effort to begin to approach what I'm talking about now. But to know that it was once so as a way of life, and that it wasn't an idea, and that you come from people ancestrally who were capable of proceeding this way, and that somehow or other this is not gone. It may not be available to you directly. It probably isn't. But for all of that, it is somehow part of your birthright. And certainly people who have a longing to work in farms and so on, a lot of young people come to my farm all the time seeking this so-called back to the land thing. And I would say, okay, forget this back, okay, because you've never been on the land. So forget back. You're going to see if you can get there. You're going to see if you can qualify to stand on a piece of ground and attempt to take care of it in a way that it's taking care of you. That I understand the motivation, but I think this is where it's coming from, the stuff I'm talking to you about now. I don't really think it's a lifestyle thing. I think it's a longing for ancestry that is kind of, in a way, whispering to you, literally through your food, literally through a piece of ground, because someone's ancestors are whispering to you from that place. And sometimes that's enough to get the old, you know, engine of longing going for you to be able to live similarly.
Stephen, thanks for being with us. That's a lot to think about, but I can't think of a better way to spend my Wednesday morning.
Well, kind of you to say. We're out here doing a lot of crazy end-of-the-season farm work, freezing, as we're doing some butchering of some of the animals coming into the wintertime. And so, you know, the things I'm telling you now, they're not stuff I'm, quote, thinking about. I'm in the backyard doing it, taking care of this end of things, and it's a great privilege to be able to do it. And the echo of that privilege is the privilege of you calling me and imagining that I might have something worthwhile to listen to say about it, and I hope I kept up my end.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
To find out more about the Orphan Wisdom School and the workshops and programs that Stephen offers, go to www.orphanwisdom.com. Join us next month for another episode of Going Shamanic, and thanks to all the folks out there that are listening, to Stephen, to our producer, Marielle. We leave you now with the Narwhal grieving song. May you live deeply and grieve well. Thank you.